I think I could listen to that all day. That was the very first thing I ever heard by Nick Drake, and I heard of him before I actually ever heard that track. And I think it's worth kind of just starting off by talking about how I first got into Nick Drake, because it's quite emblematic of the way in which probably a lot of people have ended up in getting into him. When I was at Sixth Form College at the end of the 1980s, I was organising a pop quiz. So I was that kind of nerdy kind of kid who did that sort of thing. And I'd asked the teams who were going to be in it to give me a specialist subject. And one of them had come back and said, Nick Drake. And I had no idea who Nick Drake was. So I quickly rushed off to the local record store and started leafing through the records to sort of see if I could gain some kind of question out of it. Still never actually heard any of his stuff. And then shortly afterwards, at the time... I was very into a band called All About Eve, who were a kind of psychedelic goth band at the time, and their lead singer Julianne Regan was on Radio 1, and she got to choose a track of her choice, and the very first thing she chose was River Man by Nick Drake, and it was one of those JFK moments. I remember where I was the very first time I heard River Man, in my bedroom. You know, nothing particularly remarkable, but that's where I was. He kept being a figure after that period that I kept kind of returning back to. And while I was off studying my BA and you know, trying to pursue an academic career, I was largely working in record shops. And record shops are exactly the kind of place where you find Nick Drake fans. There's certain kinds of artists that only really get listened to by people who work in record shops, and Nick Drake is possibly one of them. And one day I was doing a stock take, it was a Sunday, at a sadly now closed record store called Spinnerdisc in Northampton. The boss, who was a lovely chap but sort of didn't really like paying us, said that we could do the, for having done this stock take on a Sunday, we could have some stock of our choice, we could take a CD. And there had been this box set, the Nick Drake Fruit Tree box set, that had been sitting above the counter for years. No one had bought it, and so I sort of said, well, I know it's a bit cheeky because it's, you know, it's four albums technically, can I have that? So let me have it, and I took it home, and at the time that was the entire recorded output of Nick Drake in one box, and I still have it today and cherish it deeply. So his music's kind of been, you know, a pretty ongoing soundtrack to my life, I suppose. And about three or so years ago, I got contacted by a guy called John Scanlon up at Manchester Met, who was editing a series of books on music and place for Reaction. The series is called Reverb, and there's one on tango, Argentinian tango. There's one on Van Halen and California Zen. I'm not quite sure what that is, but I should read that at some point. And he said, I see you wrote a little bit about Nick Drake in your PhD, would you like to write a book about Nick Drake and Englishness? And I kind of thought, well, immediately I thought, yes, of course I would. That sounds great. You know, I'm between appointments. I'd like something to do. It falls on my lap for me. And then I kind of thought that two things crossed my mind. One was, well, Nick Drake and Englishness seems bleeding obvious for a variety of reasons, and I'll go into what those reasons might be. And then I thought, this is also going to kill my love of Nick Drake. I'm going to be listening to him pretty constantly for, you know, a couple of years probably. And I'm going to be sick of the sight of him, or sick of the sound of him by the time it's finished. And I'm very pleased to say I wasn't. I want to give a little bit of a biography to him. Some of you may well know some of this stuff. Again, he's one of these people who, you know, if you're into Nick Drake, you're into Nick Drake, and you kind of are aware of a lot of the biography around him. But for me, his biography is very intrinsically linked to his music, or at least the way in which we understand his music is very much framed by his biography, so it's worth kind of sketching it out a little bit. He was born in 1948 in Rangoon, in Burma, to Rodney and Molly Drake. Rodney at the time was running Bombay Trading Company? One of those two. Basically sort of supervising logging for the British Empire, really. And when Burma achieved independence, it was kind of his job to sort of hand over the Bombay Burma Trading Company, there you go, back to the newly formed Burmese government. And in 1952, he had no more job there, and the family relocated back to the UK. So at the age of four, Nick Drake ends up in Tamworth and Arden in Warwickshire. A very, very beautiful little picture postcard village. It's got a village green, it's got a church, it's got a war memorial, you know, village pub, everything you'd want really from a quintessentially English village. It's also about 10 miles away from Birmingham. I mean, it's effectively a satellite satellite suburb of Birmingham, I suppose. And even back in the 1950s, it was not a particularly cheap place to live. And indeed, Nick's dad ended up going to work for the Wolseley Engineering Company in Birmingham. Strangely enough, one of their vans passed me the other day, and I was incredibly pleased. Nick grows up in this kind of, you know, semi-rural idyll. goes off to prep school in 1961. He goes to Marlborough College in Wiltshire and spends a period of time there, learns to smoke, learns to play guitar. In 1965, he buys his first guitar. Spends a lot of time wandering around the Wiltshire countryside and not really studying quite as much as he should do. And is about to... He fails his A-levels initially, ends up having to retake them, and then is set to come to this august institution where we're sitting today. One of the provisos of him coming to Fitzwilliam was that he brush up on his French. So he and various others of his friends went off for a six-month jolly in Aix-en-Provence in France, theoretically to study French. Not really a lot of study in French going on. He discovers marijuana there. He goes off on a bit of a jolly to Morocco and tries to drive across the Sahara in a particularly claps-out car. They don't get very far. He plays some songs for the Rolling Stones, who are literally who are also in Morocco at the time. Generally has a very nice time amongst the sort of the English and American students who are there, who are probably equally not studying French very hard. But he does make it to Cambridge in 67, and it's here that he studies English literature. And this is awkward given where we are, but he doesn't have the best time here and quits after 2 years. But what happens here is quite important to his story. And sorry, I keep losing my clock, otherwise I'll rub it on for ages. What happens is quite important to his story. Some of his most important songs are written here. He records his first album while he's still living in Cambridge. Seemingly no one seems to know that that's going on. He just suddenly appears with a record on Island Records that he's gone off and recorded. But he leaves after 2 years and heads down to live in London. The London experience isn't that great. He records another album, Brighter Later. Ends up coming back to Tamworth and Arden in about 71, and he's by that time suffering very badly from depression. A number of people have kind of made the link between his recreational marijuana abuse and maybe even other drugs and that depression, but he clearly had always suffered to some extent. And in those last few years living in Tamworth, he goes into a bit of a decline. He records one more album in 1972, which is Pink Moon. And just before his death in 1974, he records another four or five tracks, which don't see the light of day until some years later. And on November the 21st, 1974, his mum walks into his bedroom and finds him lying dead on his bed from an overdose of amitriptyline. Whether it's deliberate or not is still unclear. I know his sister Gabrielle records it's accidental. Who knows, really? Nick, for a musician, I think who's as revered as he is now, sold very few records in his lifetime. Estimates have been anywhere between about 3,000 to 10,000 records across all three albums. Callie Callaman, who runs his estate, estimated sales of about 3,000, and he said, you know, it's entirely possible that some of those people may well have bought all three albums, so that might be just an audience of a UK audience of about 1,000 people, you know, which is really very little. He did a number of performances, live performances. Again, some of these are documented, some of these aren't. Some of them people only really know about through advertising, so they don't know whether he turned up or not. He was a famously reticent performer. Each song tended to have different guitar tunings, and he'd spend an awful lot of time fiddling around with his tuning pegs on his guitar, not really talking to the audience, and the music would be beautiful, but he was in no way a showman, and he very quickly decided after the second album to just give it up as a lost cause. And equally was very poor at publicising his own music. He did one interview with Jerry Gilbert for Sounds magazine, I think in 1971, and he says about 70 words, most of which are about how terrible he feels. So, you know, he's not terrifically good at kind of selling himself. But there is something that kind of comes up again and again, and it's this idea of Nick Drake as being quintessentially English. And as I said, when I first started writing this book, I kind of thought, well, this is shooting fish in a barrel, really. Of course he's wonderfully English for all kinds of reasons. So I kind of want to start off by thinking about why he might be English, whatever that means. And then I want to kind of see actually how he's not very English at all. And I guess it's worth saying that the book itself is, it's not a biography of Nick Drake. There are plenty of people who have done that much better than I could, and indeed I've borrowed quite heavily from some of the biographies that already exist. By the time I got to write it, quite a lot of the people who were involved with Nick had passed away. Robert Kirby, who did his string arrangements, died just as I sort of started doing it. John Wood, his engineer, has retired up to Aberdeen to run a B&B. His sister was a bit fed up with talking about him by that point. So there wasn't, I kind of quickly gave up trying to talk to people about him. So I talked to Kelly, who runs the estate, quite extensively. He was very, very helpful. But that kind of wasn't really the issue, because what I wanted to try and work out was, why do we keep making this association between Englishness and Nick Drake? And I suppose, what is the use of Nick Drake as a way to think about Englishness? So I guess the book's more about Englishness than it is about Nick Drake, really. And there's an implicit kind of idea behind it, which is that we quite often use music and musicians to think about various aspects of our identity, whether it's nationality, or it's class, or it's gender, or whatever. So this book's really about the use of Nick Drake to think about Englishness, and what that kind of Englishness might be. I just want to kind of give you three quotes. Sorry, I should just say, actually, these images that we're showing are pictures from the book, and most of these are taken by my friend Paul Hillary. We went on a kind of two-day jolly around sort of Nick Drake's haunts, including Fitzwilliam and other bits of Cambridge. This is Farley's in Tamworth in Arden. I'll come back to just while Nick Riverman was playing. Incredibly fortuitously, given this is on a loop, there was that wonderful picture of the cam just down that way. I'm sure you'll all recognise it. And that picture is incredibly tricky to take for the purposes of the book, shall we say, and I'll explain why in a bit. Anyway, I've picked out three quotes. There are a whole load of quotes in the book. Various people talking about Nick Drake and what he means to them, and why, where this idea of Englishness kind of fits in. So I've got three quotes. The first is from Alison Goldfrapp, a musician, talking to Pitchfork Media about her influences. And she says, "I think also what I like about Nick Drake is that he makes me think of England, you know? English countryside, ruralness," which I think is a new word she's made up, "which a lot of folk music does. Well, good folk music does, more the American stuff. There's not that much English folk music that's really appealing, but with Nick Drake there's such an atmosphere to it, which is why so many people like it." So for her there's a landscape kind of being evoked and a particular mood related to that landscape. One of the people who's written most extensively on Nick Drake, Scott Ian MacDonald, who's sadly passed away, writing in Mojo magazine, this is a wonderful image he conjures up here. He says, "To listen to Nick Drake is to step out of this world of pose and noise and enter a quiet oak-panelled room dappled with sunlight. A room opening through French windows into a lush green garden, equally quiet because we're in the country, far from the sound of the city. It's summer. Bees and birds are abroad in the shade and beyond the nearby trees. A soft tangle of voices and convivial laughter can be felt, along with the dipping of languid oars in a rushy river pardon me, that winds through cool woods and teeming meadows hereabouts. An English landscape with Gallic ghosts from Le Grand Monet and La Maison de Claudine, and an acoustic guitar playing gently beyond the hedgerow in jazzy 5/4 time." A third quote, which I found particularly useful, he's credited in the book just as Robert, because at the time this was a post on the website of a musician called Keith James, who's recreated a lot of Nick Drake's music. And all I had was Robert, but he's since been in contact asking for an acknowledgement, which is fair enough. So his name's Robert Binney, I can now reveal. he says he's basically talking about kind of growing up in the same kind of the same kind of environment as Nick. My own experience of Nick Drake's music was at a boarding school not too dissimilar to Marlborough, Worcester, in fact, with Five Leaves Left playing on the little hi-fi in the study. The end of the summer term, looking out across College Green in the Dean's Close on the private side of the cathedral. Verdant green, with the dulcet tones musing over the lawns under the wide-spreading trees. Nick fitted so well into that privileged time. Choristers, dope, and Englishness. Mm-hmm. I'll come back to choristers and dope in a bit. That was 1974, and I didn't even know that he was dead. Now, it made some sense to me, because I have very, very similar reactions to listening to Nick Drake. Riverman's I play, although it's probably one of his most best known tracks. In fact, it was described by Cali when I was talking to him as a deliberately showy track. You know, it's kind of the centerpiece in many ways of Five Leaves Left, the first album, and it encapsulates a lot of the things that people seem to like about Nick. But I listened to it, and there's a very specific kind of landscape evoked by it. For me, and I'll talk about what that is in a second. But that landscape that people keep talking about seems kind of immediately recognisable. But it's a very particular landscape. It's not Celtic in any way. It's very specifically English as opposed to British, and it's very perhaps specifically home counties. It's not moor music, it's not mountain music, it's gentle rolling hills, it's rivers, it's, you know, it's all that languid greenery, you know, the kind of language you hear there. So what are the things that kind of people are picking up on? Well, the first thing really, I guess, is his accent. Drake came from a relatively well-to-do upper middle class background, private school, came to Cambridge, which at the time perhaps marked him out as being from a certain kind of class background. Certainly, you know, the people kind of coming out of Marlborough and similar kinds of schools would be expected to kind of go on to university. You know, this is before Tony Blair decides that half the population's got to go. And you don't hear him speak an awful lot. There are a couple of recordings of him talking. The best one is him rolling home from a party back to Tamworth in Arden, and he wanders into the music room, and this is about 3 o'clock in the morning or something, and he sticks on the tape recorder and just starts ranting on about some party he's been to and some girl he's met. But he sounds almost like Prince Philip. He's got this kind of incredibly cut glass received pronunciation kind of thing going on, and you hear that in his music. And it's worth bearing in mind that in the 1960s it was still very rare for British musicians to sing in their own accent. A lot of people kind of talk about the Beatles, but even the Beatles, I hear an Americanness to it. People like Colin Blunstone from The Animals, Clifford T. Ward, there are very few of them particularly. And even now, when you kind of hear British or English musicians singing what is identifiably a British accent, it tends to not be that home county's accent. It tends to be, you know, Alex Turner from the Arctic Monkeys and that kind of Sheffield thing going on, or it's a Mancunian or it's a Liverpudlian, so quite often a northern regional kind of accent. So that very kind of almost establishment voice seems to really stand out, and it seems to kind of specifically relate to a certain kind of English experience. The instrumentation, equally, certainly for the first and the third album, Five Leaves Left and Pink Moon, is primarily acoustic, Nick playing his acoustic guitar, that theoretically, on Poor Boy, on Brighter Later, some people think he's playing an electric, and I can't find anything to corroborate this, but he largely seems to be playing acoustic guitar. Certainly on the first album, there are a lot of strings, which are all orchestrated by, or mostly orchestrated by Robert Kirby. And there's a little bit of brass, there's Danny Thompson's double bass, there's a little bit of electric guitar. Brighter Later, the second album, is more fully orchestrated and has a bigger pop sound. But even there, there are moments of acousticity going on. And then the third album, Pink Moon, is entirely just his voice, his acoustic guitar, one piano overdub on the first track, and that's it. It's very, very Spartan. And to my ears, the thing that comes through the most is this reverberation of wood, of the material of wood. It's something I didn't kind of really explore in the book. I was at the point where I was going to start going off and finding out about the frequency ranges of certain different types of wood, but it's beyond my ken, so I decided to stop. But there is something about the sound of wood and the resonant sound of wood that seems to kind of really resonate with the English imagination, I suppose. He seems to be situated within a folk scene, and Alison Goldfrapp makes that point about him being a folk artist, but he's not a folk artist in any way, shape or form. He's an acoustic artist, and he's an acoustic artist who is playing, particularly in the acoustic scene in London, at a time when the more traditional folk scene is morphing into something slightly different, and particularly because of American influences. You have, particularly around the Les Cousins club in Soho, where Drake played a few times, you've got people like John Martin, you've got Vashti Bunyan, Paul Simon, even at that point, Ralph McTell. Donovan is doing very well at that kind of time. The counterculture is obviously making use of that kind of woodiness and the link to kind of folk music to kind of evoke something that seems slightly outside of the mainstream. But Nick is not really a folk player, even though he's playing acoustically. But it's interesting that kind of confusion is often made. There are certain kinds of classical influences that a number of people have picked up on. Vaughan Williams and Delius kind of crop up a number of times, in particularly the phrasing of the strings in Robert Kirby's arrangements. And I think it's also worth bearing in mind that Robert Kirby's arrangements go a long way to shaping the sound. And there is the sound itself, and I played Riverman because Riverman very much evokes something spatial. It's landscape music. It obviously sets that up by the title. It seems to be by a river, but the music equally seems to be mimicking that idea. The 5-4 rhythm, to me, and I was just saying to Kasia before, that an awful lot of my readings of the music in the book seem to me very subjective, and you may well read them in entirely different ways, but they're vital for that kind of evoking, of evocation of Englishness. That 5-4 rhythm is lapping water. The strings are clouds moving across the sun, and there's sunlight moving through at various different points. Others of his songs, the guitars play a tree-like role, with flutes sort of dappling a landscape with light. And indeed, the dynamic of the music again evokes that sort of rolling landscape. There's an image that was probably a couple of slides back, which is the view from the graveyard in Temuth Norton, where his ashes are interred. We took that photograph because it was a snapshot of this archetypal English landscape, looking, you know, that you hear in Nick Drake's music. So there seems to be a pastoralism going on there, and that's in his lyrics as well. There's a lot of nature imagery. There's a lot of weather going on. And also, for me, it's not just about the music, it's about the iconography that presents Nick Drake to us with the albums initially. Pretty much all the photographs of him are taken by Keith Morris, who also sadly passed away just before I got the chance to talk to him. A lot of Keith Morris's image, this is a good example, on the cover. He's sitting under a tree in the grass, and it looks very rural and pastoral and lovely. I think that's actually Regent's Park in London. It's actually quite a metropolitan image, but it's framed in such a way that it looks perhaps more bucolic than it really is. And the image, again, sort of a slide or so back, of Nick standing leaning against the wall as a running figure goes past, which is, you know, theoretically a homage to Henri Cartier-Bresson's images of people, sort of blurred people jumping over puddles behind Parisian train stations. When he is in an urban setting, he's static and the environment is moving around him. He seems to be at odds with it. There's another image on the back of Brighter Later, where he's standing on the flyover, the Hammersmith flyover on the A40, watching a car go past. And the interesting thing is, if he went to that place, there's no reason for him to be up on that. There's no pedestrian access. He shouldn't really be there. It's the middle of the night. He seems to kind of be being propelled almost against his will through the city. Whereas he's presented as being in a much more kind of relaxed atmosphere in these kind of pseudo countryside settings. So the imagery is kind of playing on that too. And I'll talk a little bit towards the end about how the subsequent releases, the posthumous releases, have really played on that idea. And then there are slightly more intangible things. A lot of people talk about Nick Drake as being a melancholic singer, and there is a melancholy there. Melancholy and loss. A lot of Drake's songs are about almost kind of missing opportunities. He's like Morrissey in that respect. He's about thwarted ambition, thwarted love, things not quite working out the way they were supposed to. And again, in the book, I talk quite a bit about the way in which that idea of loss might actually shape a way of thinking about England. That we tend to think about England almost as something that's just been lost, or that's being under threat. Certain discourses, particularly, present Englishness as something, as a defensive position against outside attacks, whether that's from immigration, whether it's from modernity, whether it's, you know, council estates, whatever it is, you know, the cricket pitch and the village pub are going to be encroached by, you know, gypsies or something. I don't know, whatever. But that idea of Englishness. Englishness being something that's almost just about to go. And that idea of loss kind of appearing through his music equally seems to be quintessentially English. I talk about Peter Ackroyd's book Albion in there, and he describes melancholy and loss as being distinctly kind of Anglo-Saxon characteristics that make their way into kind of forms like the elegy, for example, in poetry. So he seems to be tapping into that. So maybe all of those things kind of make for this idea of Englishness. I knew I'd have everyone. Okay, I'll try me quick. What doesn't make it English? Well, I said I thought it'd be easy, and I very quickly realised that actually that was nonsense. There are a whole lot of things that complicate it, not least of which the influence of the blues in his music. If you listen to any of his home recordings, and these have been released particularly on the Family Tree album, before he releases Five Leaves Left, his debut album, everything he's recording is blues or American folk music. He's doing Bob Dylan covers. He does, I think, four different covers from an album by a guy called Jackson C. Frank, who equally was a kind of American folk artist who kind of came over to the UK and equally suffered from mental health issues. Another kind of lost folk artist in many ways. There's a certain element of European, particularly French chanson, to the way he sings, perhaps, and the kind of, again, that melancholic sort of feeling. He was briefly going to work with Francois Hardy, and apparently rolled up at her door, knocked on it, and then, you know, chickened out and ran off in Paris. And it was kind of interesting, actually, sort of, when I went down to Marlborough College, I was looking back through their sort of newsletters, student newsletters called the Marlburian from 1965, and one of his, I don't think Nick Drake drew this, but there's a rather nice little pen study of Francois Hardy in the Marlburian in 65. So this would have been someone who, you know, he would have been aware of, and you know, probably as a young teenager, you know, might have may well have liked, and you know, that would have been a really interesting collaboration. Jazz is a big thing, and you hear jazz perhaps more in his music than you do blues. There's particularly a kind of a modal approach, not only to his singing, but his playing as well, and a number of people have kind of made connections between his singing style. He started off as a saxophonist, and you can kind of hear a sort of very jazz-inflected instrumental approach to his singing. Even now, after all these years, there are songs I couldn't really tell you what the lyrics are of Nick Drake's, but I could hum them. You know, they're really interesting kind of modal structures. And he was clearly kind of influenced by people like Miles Davis and John Coltrane and various others, and you can kind of hear that working its way into his music. And bear in mind also that a lot of the session musicians playing on his music at that time are kind of coming out of the they're either jazzers or they're kind of in that hinterland between jazz and folk music. People like Danny Thompson, who plays bass, who at the time was playing in Pentangle at Fairport Convention. And you also hear sort of even more kind of esoteric influences. Trevor Dan, who wrote one of the biographies, hears Indian Veena music in the track Horn on the last album. So there's quite a cosmopolitan range of influences, and it's not all pastoral either. You can kind of, broadly speaking, split the three albums up into different places. Five Leaves Left is the Tamworth and Cambridge years. It's green, it's rural, it's all of those kinds of things. Brighter Later is his London album, and it's the album where the instrumentation gets poppier. There are drums, shock horror. Joe Boyd, at which season his management company was really kind of trying to push him as a pop artist. And Nick didn't seem overly, you know, reticent about doing that. There was a lot of saxophone, which seems to kind of evoke an urban space, car horns, and Americanism, and the New York, kind of New York kind of ambience, strangely. And then the third album, Pink Moon, is perhaps not so much a physical space, but it's the inside of Nick Drake's head. And it's that period where he's retreated back to his childhood home. He's becoming more and more interiorised, more and more kind of wound up in himself, I suppose. And hence you get this very kind of Spartan album. A lot of people sort of suggest it's rather miserable. I find it rather beautiful, to be honest with you. And it finishes on one of his most uplifting tracks, From the Morning. So it's not wholly... His body of work is not wholly this kind of nostalgic pastoral idyll. It's actually quite cosmopolitan. It's quite an interesting kind of document over the three albums of that period in the late 1960s, where, you know, kind of school kids are listening to, you know, bebop and discussing Jung in private schools. And, you know, he comes entirely out of that environment. I kind of said Cambridge was quite pivotal in some ways, although he clearly didn't kind of connect terribly well with his studies while he was here. Some of the most important things that happened to him happened in Cambridge. He initially lived on campus in what was room A2. I think it's now P2, possibly. I may be wrong. Paul just showed me around. And while the accommodation here is wonderful, it's quite a small room. I believe at the time it was effectively looking out onto a fence, which then looked out onto a car park in what's now Tree Court. And he quickly moved out from here to Carlisle Road and then Chesterton Road and Hills Road. So he moved around a little bit while he was in Cambridge. Wasn't doing terribly well, got a third in his first year, was quite reticent and wasn't really kind of engaging with his studies. I've got a quote from Maurice Hussey, who was one of his tutors at the time. He says, "It's taken a month of extremely dull essays to reach the point at which he's begun to show little vitality and intellectual initiative." And you can almost imagine Nick sort of sitting kind of very sort of sullen. And, you know, there's probably quite a lot going on up there, but he's really not kind of punting it out there. But what he is doing is he's honing his guitar technique. And he's really throwing himself into that, you know, very fully. He's only by this point been playing guitar a couple of years, but he's already become a very proficient technical guitarist. And is spending all of his spare time in his room beavering away. He meets Robert Kirby, who's a key student while he's here. They both audition for the Footlights Review. I don't think either of them get in. Well, I know neither of them get in. But they meet up and Kirby starts to arrange string sections for Drake's music. They record a demo tape at the Bateman Room. At Keys, and Drake starts doing a few gigs. There are three potentially that are attributable to Cambridge. One is the May Ball at Donwell and Keys. One's at the Pit Club, and possibly he played the Cow. Is the Cow still there opposite the Corn Exchange? That's reassuring. Okay, I thought it had gone for some reason. And clearly there's something about Cambridge that kind of appears in his work. I was hoping that the slide would come back. But the when we were kind of scouting around taking photographs, it was kind of suggested that one of the influences on Riverman particularly was the walk from Carlisle Road down into town, kind of crossing Jesus Green. He would have crossed over the little footbridge There's a weir there, isn't there? It's been, what, I don't think I've been back since I was there for this. And the River Man seemed to kind of be evoked by that place. What I thought was really interesting was the fact that on the two sides of the river, you've got two very different experiences. You've got looking one way, beautiful big green expanse, trees, all these kinds of things. Look the other way, lots of Victorian terraces. And indeed, kind of taking the shot of the willow tree by the bridge, which I hate to say was really, you know, we didn't stage it, willow tree was there, but you know, we were very kind of careful to get a particular kind of shot, because it was quite hard to get something that wasn't just full of people and cars and, you know, quite urban looking. But it's that kind of tension that I think is being played out in Nick Drake's music. It's not countryside music, it's actually about being suspended between the urban and the rural, between the pastoral and the modern, in some way. So it provides a slightly more kind of sophisticated idea of Englishness, one that isn't wholly nostalgic. It's actually reflecting back on, you know, new jazz and modernity. And kind of Cambridge seems to sum that up a little bit. I was born in Essex, North Essex, and, you know, Cambridge is somewhere I've been to an awful lot, and I'm madly drawn to its medievalism and history. Yet it's also somewhere, you know, which is... I think I had to tone down the phrase I used in the book. The editor got a bit upset with me, but you know, I started going on about the white heat of modernity as well. You know, this is Cambridge, and it's science, and it's the future. That tension, the space, seems to kind of work its way through his music. Interestingly, this place, this university, seems to also kind of evoke that. Trevor Dann, in his biography, is I think relatively rude about this place, actually, and you know, it's modernist architecture, the Dennis Lansdowne stuff that sort of appears in the 1960s, and it is, you know, it's a modernist building in many ways, a modernist campus in many ways, and seems very much at odds with the more kind of, you know, traditional image of Cambridge University buildings. But, of course, at the heart of it, you have the Grove, you know, this beautiful Regency building, which I was incredibly pleased in a moment of fortuitousness, luck, to see the wallpaper. I don't know how many of you have been in there, but the wallpaper framed on the wall, which is it definitely William Morris? They suggested it was attributed to William Morris at the time. It's near enough for me. And William Morris, of course, who interestingly also went to Marlborough College, you know, represents again this kind of tension between the past, you know, the arts and crafts movement being a kind of reaction against sort of the threat of industrialisation, I suppose, but also a kind of a new radical politics and a socialist kind of agenda, and that kind of broader romantic strain, which isn't wholly nostalgic, it's very much a product of its time, and it's a product of modernity, even if it's a reaction to it, seem to really kind of sum up Nick Drake. Again, the William Morris thing came up later when I was looking through the Made to Love Magic album, which is a collection of his stuff released after his death. And Callie Callaman, who, as I said, manages his estate, but also is an art director, had done all the inside art, and lo and behold, there is a piece of William Morris wallpaper. It's not the same one. Sort of just adorning the inside of the CD liner. So all of these things are kind of trickling out, I suppose. And particularly, you know, the kind of the tension in the biography of Nick Drake between kind of the country and the city. You know, he starts off in Rangoon, and there are a whole load of imperial issues to deal with there as well. But he ends up in Tamworth and Arden, you know, the beautiful quintessential English village, ends up in Cambridge and then subsequently London, and then can't hack it, and kind of ends up coming back to home, where he just sort of slowly disappears. But that the city's always there, the urban is always there in his music, and you hear it particularly. I don't know if I've got the time to play it. Perhaps I'll play it at the end. particularly on Brighter Later, on a track like At the Chime of a City Clock, you hear this urban space. You know, you're almost, again, the mental image I have is of being suspended, maybe, you know, on the first or second floor of a building, looking out through the window. Saxophones, cars kind of going past, and it's very, very urban, very metropolitan, but Nick's kind of a bit too immobile to engage with it. I just want to finish by kind of talking about what the point of all this is, really, is, because the book's really about how we use Nick Drake. And I was as much interested in what had happened to him since his death, or his music since his death, and in his audience. He's now, through word of mouth, developed a big international following, and there are all these books. You had Gorm here last week, which sadly I couldn't come to. His music, you may all know this, the track Pink Moon was used in an advert for the Volkswagen Cabrio in 1999, and in 1 month in America he sold more records than he did in his entire lifetime, which is terribly sad. Good for his estate. And there have been a number of reissues and best-ofs. Just recently you can buy all of his music reissued in a box set made to look like the tuck box that he took to Marlborough, which is quite telling in many ways. And the iconography has continued to kind of play on this kind of rurality, I think. Not just the Keith Morris images, but also the artwork that Callie's done subsequently. It's an interesting way you hear his music. You hear it all the time on probably, I hear it more on TV than I ever do on the radio. I rarely hear Nick Drake on the radio. I hear it a lot on Countryfile, particularly cello song. Every time there's a rolling field, it's suddenly, you know, the guitar bit at the beginning kind of kicks off. And I talk in the book about two particular instances. I was told to not talk about Delia Smith too much, but Delia Smith's classic Christmas from a few years ago used two Nick Drake tracks. Michel Roux's Service, which was just a one-off series, but took a bunch of, you know, disadvantaged kids and then taught them how to wait, you know, do silver service and whatnot, and wait at table, and do front of house in restaurants, used some Nick Drake. And both of those are harking back to a slightly lost idea of Englishness that's of use to us, you know, a period of austerity. You know, the same idea of the keep calm and carry on poster and its popularity, a reassurance in a slightly lost version of Englishness that we can use today. Nick Drake, for me, does the same thing. And it's because of that Choristers and Dope quote. It's that collision between a kind of an Anglican, pastoral, Middle England and a radical counterculture, which Drake was, you know, on the outskirts of. And for listeners now, I think he represents something both radical and nostalgic, and there's a kind of conciliation between those two things. And I think if we use him to kind of think about Englishness, it's about that tension between the past and the future, perhaps a slightly conservative nostalgia and a slightly more radical metropolitan multiculturalism. It's interesting, one of the best covers of Nick Drake's songs is Mayfair, which wasn't released on one of his albums, came out on one of the collections later on, but was subsequently covered by Millie, more famous for doing My Boy Lollipop, and it really works as a ska track. You know, and had he lived, perhaps that's the way his career would go. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking. Thank you very much. Kesha suggested we go to the bar and